Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason Mann, and with me today is Mick Finnis. He is the author of The Curse, the colorful and chaotic history of the LA Clippers. Mick, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me.
So we are going to talk about your book and some of the important moments, maybe a few of the not so important moments in the LA Clippers history. Of course, under the stewardship of Donald Sterling, they were known mostly for their ineptitude. And, you know, I was a bit surprised after reading this book, which, by the way, is terrific. Highly recommend anyone to learning about the history of the team. It's just some really great overall NBA history. Checking out this book, there is just so much good stuff. I was very pleased to read it. But I was surprised at... Obviously, there are the negative aspects of Donald Sterling's ownership that we know about, the personally embarrassing behavior, the cutting corners, the bad draft picks, the bad trade decisions, the inconsistency, the feuds with players, the feuds with management, all that kind of stuff. But I was also a bit surprised about just how much the Clippers' woes really could be attributed just to bad luck as well. There was a lot of that in addition to all the, you know, the things that we know about bad ownership and bad stewardship of a team.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's really striking about the franchise, and maybe outside of actual Clipper fans, maybe that is something that's a lesser known sort of fact. But through my time researching for the book, you know, what you uncover is that over the past 38 years, 39 years, there's been so many occasions where the team looks like they've positioned themselves to, you know, become serious, maybe not championship contenders, but put themselves in a position where they're ready to sort of build towards a championship, and that often was derailed by nothing more than, like you said, simple plain bad luck, whether it be through injury or some other unforeseen circumstance.
Yeah, and we'll get to it, but there were season-ending injuries to their best or second-best players for, I believe, 5 straight seasons from the late 80s to the early 90s. So most of that, I mean, you know, that there's always perhaps, you know, cutting corners in a training staff, and there may be some things that are more than just luck in the situation. But you even considering that, that is just an extraordinary amount of, again, bad luck.
Yeah, and even some, I think what you touched on, Jason, is an interesting idea that no one will ever be able to prove one way or another. But whether unwillingness to sort of spend money on things like training and medical resources, whether that impacted on the bad run of injuries. But I mean, some of the injuries that happened, like even the way that they occurred, were such freak injuries. I mean, you had Norm Nixon injure himself playing softball in the off season at Central Park, and at the time, Norm Nixon was one of the best two or three point guards in the NBA. And then you had Marcus Johnson injure himself when he grabbed a rebound, made an outlet pass and turned to run up the court and ran into Benoit Benjamin's chest, and you know, and suffered a really serious neck injury that effectively killed his career off. So I mean, those types of circumstances are just bizarre and you know, can't be sort of explained.
Yeah, exactly. And there are, you know, perhaps there is something to the idea where if you just create this atmosphere where there's so much negativity and there's so much angst and people aren't having fun, or they're, you know, just worried about their position or what have you, that stuff just kind of tends to happen a little bit more often, because you just, a negative attitude can, you know, kind of spread throughout, you know, those types of attitudes can be, you know, contagious in a sense, or just lead to bad circumstances. I mean, there may be something to that, but still, there is so much that, and we're going to get to a lot of it, that is just quite baffling. So even though I don't believe in, you know, universally in curses, this is about as close as I'm willing to get, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And the title, I mean, the title of the book's been something that's been, you know, different fans of the team have contacted me, and some people are really like the title. Some people dislike it. I suppose the title that I, the reason why the title was selected was because I thought it was the best way of encapsulating the experience of being a Clippers fan for the past, you know, few decades. I mean, I can't imagine. I personally don't believe in curses either. I don't believe there's some sort of mystic force that's preventing the franchise from doing well. But at some point, if you're a Clippers fan, you'd have to sort of throw your hands up in the air in despair and say, well, why does this stuff keep happening to us?
I think that mystic force was Dallin Sterling personally, but you know.
Yeah.
So let's start with Dallin Sterling, because obviously he is here throughout most of the history of the team. He becomes the owner, I believe, in the 81 season, and taking over from Irv Levin, who had who was the owner. He had been the owner of the Celtics, and then had an exchange of franchises with the owner of the Buffalo Braves, John Y. Brown, and then took the Braves and moved them to San Diego. There was a complicated exchange of players and so forth. So the first San Diego team is essentially a mix of old Celtics, a few old Braves, and some other spare parts. And they're, you know, a pretty solid team for a couple years under Gene Shue. Bill Walton comes there in 1980 in free agency. He's from San Diego. There's a big hoopla around that, despite the fact that Walton has, you know, already missed, you know, a couple of seasons with injuries. Then Dallin Sterling comes along after the first season, in which Walton misses most of it with injury. But there's still, I think, you know, there's some decent talent there. There's some decent optimism. I still think that the Clippers can work in San Diego. Donald Sterling, you know, is not, his reputation has not preceded him yet. He was involved with a real estate transaction with Jerry Buss. You know, obviously he's admitted to this club. I don't know what kind of vetting there was for sales in 81 or 82, but presumably, you know, he was allowed to buy the team. So there was not necessarily no big opposition to it at the time. But it doesn't take long for people to realize that Sterling really is a problem for the team and for the league.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there's a couple of things that he did in his first season that sort of alerted people that this was maybe not your regular NBA owner. I mean, one of the first things he did was the media campaign leading into that first season when he was the owner. he placed himself front and center of that. You know, his picture was the one that was plastered on billboards around San Diego, which, I mean, I think shows sort of a real lack of understanding about why NBA fans would attend games. I mean, even if he was a really prominent public figure that people knew, no one's going to buy a ticket to a game to see an owner sitting on the side of the court. So I think moving the focus away from the players and putting it on himself to start off his time was a very unusual decision. But the big move he made in the first season that caused a lot of friction was he announced at a luncheon that the team was effectively tanking to try and secure the number one draft pick. And at that time, Ralph Sampson was a junior at Virginia. And, I mean, it's easy to look back now at Ralph Sampson and have a different sort of view of his career. But at the time when Ralph Sampson was playing college basketball, he was, you know, the most hyped college player since Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And so the idea that a team, a franchise would deliberately lose games, at the time the Clippers weren't going to make the playoffs. So the idea that they would deliberately lose games to try and put themselves in a position to draft Sampson was not unusual, but the thing that was unusual was an owner publicly declaring it and what type of impact that would have on ticket sales. I mean, this is the early 80s. It's not the NBA. I mean, that's one thing that people need to really understand, that, you know, the NBA of 2017 compared to the NBA of the early 80s was two very different leagues. And this was, you know, at the time the Clippers were averaging, you know, less than 5,000 fans to a game. So, you know, an owner coming out and saying, well, we're going to now start losing games and our aim is to finish last, it doesn't really place much incentive on the fan to part with their hard-earned money to go and watch the team play. And at the time, you know, the players and the team were really discouraged by him coming out and saying that. So, yeah, I mean, his first season, I mean, that was probably the first catastrophic act in the Donald Sterling saga.
Yeah, and there were also, you know, immediately there were questions about, you know, he was running the team on, you know, a very shoestring budget. There's an anecdote in your book that I think really illustrates things well about Paul Silas had a lot of indignities suffered upon him as Clippers coach, but I think the biggest one, other than perhaps losing his office to one of the executives there, but I think the other one was Donald Sterling with having the idea that he should tape the players before the game, you know, thinking that he could just do that as well as be a coach in the for the team, of course, not having understanding of, you know, respect for what the coach has to do and respect for the position that would obviously, you know, put him in if he were the guy who's forced to do that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that type of stuff happened throughout Sterling's tenure as the team's owner. And I think that reflects, I mean, you know, you spot on, Jason. I mean, it reflects a real lack of understanding about what takes place in a locker room of a sporting team, and the idea that the coach would be taping ankles and also then moving into the position of being the coach and calling the shots during the game. I mean, that's a completely sort of ludicrous suggestion, and anyone who knows basketball or any sport for that matter would you know, not even consider that at a professional level. But I think that also shows that's one example of many throughout his time as owner, shows that the way he looked at his ownership was very different than the bulk of his peers. You know, most NBA owners, I believe, buy the teams with the understanding that they may make money, they may lose money, that they buy the teams when they're in a position where they have so much wealth in other areas of their life that they don't need their NBA franchise to necessarily be turning a big profit. And they buy the teams with the idea that they want to be successful and boost their public profile and be part of a winning organization. I don't believe from my time I've spent, you know, speaking with a lot of people around the franchise, I formed the view that I think Donald had a very different view, and I think he thought that the Clippers were expected to perform financially and return money for him at the same rate as his other investments. So I believe that he looked at it in the same way as he would look at cutting costs in, you know, a apartment building that he was renting out. So he was looking at ways to boost revenue and cut costs. And so no idea was off the table for him. And if that meant that the team was less successful, that was probably, it seemed to be less of a concern for him in terms of wins and losses. And the bigger concern seemed to be in terms of his profit margins.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing that I was surprised about was the fact that the talk of, I mean, even the announcement of that he was going to be moving the team to Los Angeles actually took place a couple of years before he did it. I didn't realize that, the fight with that started, I believe, in the 82 offseason.
Yeah. So, I mean, he decided that he was going to move the team. And this is also another thing that sort of it remained a constant throughout his time as the owner was his willingness to sort of buck trends and say he didn't really care about sort of what were the accepted norms in the world of in the NBA world. You know, he didn't look at it as like, this is what I'm meant to do as an NBA owner. He looked at it in terms of the legal side of things, what I legally could and could not do as an NBA owner. So his idea was that he'd bought this asset, which was the Clippers, and if they weren't making enough money for him in San Diego, he was well within his right to pick the team up and move them to Los Angeles, the same as you would any other asset that you had purchased. But I mean, the NBA obviously is a whole different entity, and there's if every team around the league just sort of moved to the major sort of markets, you'd end up with eight teams in New York and eight teams in Los Angeles. So, and the NBA had bylaws around that. They had a bylaw that said you couldn't move within 75 mile radius of an existing franchise without getting permission from the ownership group of that franchise. But Donald Sterling, that didn't seem to faze him. He more seemed to take the approach of, I'm going to move the team and then we'll deal with the legal fight afterwards. I'm going to go on the front foot. I'm going to move the team. And the first time around, he was unsuccessful. And so that led to sort of this press conference where they, tucked their tail between their legs and said, oh, we're actually staying in San Diego. But then there was no commitment to stay long term. It was, we'll play the next season in San Diego. And he just sort of bided his time and then went for it again and did the same thing when he went for it again. He didn't go through sort of getting permission from the league to move the team. The second time when he moved, it was the same thing. It was like, we're going to Los Angeles. He announced it. And then he sort of sat back and said, now let's see what anyone's going to do. Who's going to challenge me?
And, after the first attempt to relocate, the NBA had a investigation into, his financial practices on the team. And he was very close to, being kicked out of the NBA. I mean, at this point, there was a talk of teams being contracted anyway. The situation in Cleveland was bad. There were a couple other markets that were very bad. We're just a couple years from, the NBA really turning around and being, financially solid and then exploding. But, at this time, there were real struggles. And, there was a vote that was planned to, to decide whether he would be able to stay in the league. And, that ended up getting postponed, and eventually he sort of pledged to change, and they let it go. But I thought that was really interesting. I also thought it was interesting David Stern's role in, preventing and keeping that, vote from happening. I mean, not necessarily that he was, actively campaigning in favor of Sterling and anything like that, but, you mentioned him specifically as someone who, was pushing for there to be a delay in that vote. I thought that was interesting that the NBA was very close to getting rid of Donald Sterling forever, but it would have him another 30 years in the league. I mean, so much could have been avoided, I guess, if they had taken care of the problem then.
Yeah, and if you look at it from the NBA's perspective, I guess the idea of having to sort of forcefully take a franchise away from an ownership group or contract the league would be something that they wanted to avoid. So when Donald Sterling sort of took steps to say, originally he presented it as he was taking steps to improve the position of the franchise to get ready for a sale. And part of that was he took on the recommendation of employing Alan Rothenberg, and so the league saw it as, okay, he's going to sell the team, and he's getting sort of everything. He's trying to put the franchise in the best position so that he can sell the team and get a good price for it. I mean, a few months later, when they went to the NBA and said, look, we don't want to sell and we've done all these things to improve, I mean, I could see from the NBA's perspective why they would have said, okay, here's an owner who sort of came in, maybe didn't really understand the business, and now is sort of showing a willingness to sort of do things the expected way. So, I mean, you can understand the NBA's backing off from the having the vote to kick him out of the league. And, I mean, there's no way to have predicted what was to come. And after Donald Sterling made that presentation to the league, the next few years he was very quiet. He did take a back seat. I mean, the franchise continued to flounder during that time, but he did take a back seat during that time.
I mean, obviously you're not going to know what happens in the future, but it is interesting that came relatively close to happening. I mean, obviously there were concerns early and, you know, he may have backed off a few years and not been quite as much of an embarrassment. And certainly, you know, even when the revelations came in 2012, I mean, a lot of that had been, a public domain, obviously, you know, the discrimination lawsuits, and there was certainly a track record there, but even like sort of the level of how vile, you know, some of his beliefs and some of, you know, what he had done and some of the things that he had said over the years, you know, they may have been pretty well known in NBA circles, but they certainly, I think the degree of it even surprised, you know, people who were pretty, you know, closely observed the NBA and kind of knew what he was all about. So, it obviously impossible to know what was going to happen then, but it is interesting. Again, that was a thing that was very, you know, reasonably close to, you know, being reality. I want to transition a little bit to, it's interesting because, you know, they were more of a middling team in those first few years. They weren't, you know, really a terrible team until later. 82, they had a really rough year, but that was a year where, you know, Walton again missed the entire season. They had a lot of injuries, so and they ended up getting Terry Cummings out of that deal. So, but other than that, you know, they were more on the, you know, before that, they were more just kind of a, you know, like a solid OK team. They had, World Be Free early on as, you know, he was the second leading scorer in the NBA. They did have some talent. There was some promise, especially, you know, with the idea if Walton had been healthy. I mean, if they had, you know, there's a lot of what ifs if Walton had been healthy, but they were not necessarily in a terrible position at first. It was sort of, you know, the next few years when things would get bad, but even when things, you know, really got bad from 82 through 84, they drafted pretty well. They drafted Tom Chambers. They drafted Terry Cummings, as we mentioned. They certainly had a young core of talent where, things could have come together.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, the front office in the early 80s did a fantastic job. I mean, you mentioned Chambers and Cummings, and then the third draft after that, they drafted Byron Scott. So, I mean, there's three guys that go on to have, you know, tremendously successful careers, and they had players like Ricky Pierce and Craig Hodges at that time as well, all really young players. They had a really nice young core of players. But as was the consistent theme throughout the franchise's history, that they didn't have trouble obtaining good young players. They always had trouble keeping them once their initial contract ran out.
Right. I mean, in 84, they traded Chambers for James Donaldson, I think actually before 84, I believe. And right before the season, they ended up trading Sven Nader and Byron Scott for Norm Nixon. And then before the 85 season, the huge trade was Terry Cummings, Ricky Pierce, and Craig Hodges to the Bucks for Marcus Johnson, Junior Bridgman, and Harvey Catchings in cash. And, you know, one of those trades may have been defensible. I mean, Norm Nixon was an all-star point guard, really good. You know, okay, you know, you trade Byron Scott to get him in, that might make some sense. You know, Marcus Johnson was, you know, really a tremendous player. He was older, he was 28, but you know, you could have expected, you know, maybe 5 good years out of him before things retired. So, you know, you make one of those moves, it's kind of understandable. The other talent in that Cummings trade was way too much. But I can see, you know, Cummings wanting to leave the team. I can see some of the thinking, you know, but it's more the collection of moves and the constant, you know, going young for old and trying to get, you know, local stars that were would help the box office, which, you know, it is certainly still kind of a consideration with where the business of the NBA was at the time. Those things obviously added up, and obviously the thing that, you know, was overshadowing everything was, you know, Bill Walton still being under contract. You know, missing both the 81-82 seasons, playing 33 games in 83 and then 84, actually, you know, playing, I believe, almost 60 games and finally, you know, being relatively close to a full-time contributor. But at that point, of course, he'd obviously, his skills had diminished. But, you know, I guess the overall reaching point is that, you know, there were things here that they, you know, there was talent here, there were good players, there was, you know, if things had just been a little different, if they had just, you know, made one of those trades instead of, you know, 3 or 4 of those trades, you know, things could have been very different. But unfortunately, obviously, we know the way that things worked out.
Yeah, and it's kind of maybe a good comparison is the sort of, you know, post Patrick Ewing New York Knicks in that idea of just constantly looking to top up your talent level with guys who are sort of in the later stages of their career, and the idea being like we get one or two more good players, we can get back to the playoffs, or this will help us at the box office. So, like you said, I mean, all those trades made sense. I mean, look, in hindsight, they were all bad trades, but you know, you can see the logic at the time. I mean, James Donaldson went on to be an all-star. He was a young player. Bill Walton was injured. You know, they got a first-round draft pick out of it as well. You know, Byron Scott was an unproven rookie. Norm Nixon was, like I said, you know, you could make a case that he was the second-best point guard in the NBA at the time, second to only to his teammate of Magic. And, you know, Norm Nixon played 2 excellent seasons for the Clippers before he got injured. You know, Marcus Johnson was at a time was regarded as one of the league's, you know, best 5 or 6 players, and he was still 28 at the time when they traded for him, and that was just when the franchise had moved to Los Angeles. And Marcus Johnson was, you know, born and bred in LA and, you know, former UCLA player and really beloved figure in Southern California. So like you said, I mean, those deals seem to make sense on one level, but the sort of put them all together and the cumulative effect was that they really crippled the team because, you know, as the older players and then a lot of them became injured, and they also traded away other little assets along the way, first round draft picks and other sort of bench players that were that went on to be really successful players. And it reminds me a lot of what the Knicks did, you know, where they would bring in Penny Hardaway and then bring in Stephen Marbury and, you know, just like constantly looking to sort of look for a quick fix rather than what we know now, what's sort of the prevailing view in the NBA now, which is that, you know, you can't build a championship contender on the fly, and you've got to take the long-term view and you've got to do it through the draft and you've got to develop players. And that was obviously the opposite of the approach that the Clippers were taking.
Yeah. You know, I think one player that typifies the Clippers in the latter half of the 80s is Benoit Benjamin, a guy who had potential, you know, had good size, you know, had some good skill, but it really lacked the you know, the interest in working hard, the interest in, you know, bettering his game, and also had the kind of ego where you didn't necessarily think that he had to improve. Do you think it's a, you know, pretty fair summary of Benoit Benjamin?
Yeah, and I think the NBA history is filled with especially centers that maybe you know, scattered throughout NBA history, there are these players, and that particularly, you know, in terms of big players that maybe don't especially love playing basketball, but have sort of fallen into playing professional basketball because of their physical attributes, you know, namely their size. And, you know, that's the impression that I got with Benoit, that he was someone that didn't really have a passion for the game. You know, at college, he was able to succeed just through his sheer advantage he had over the players he was playing against. But when he got to the NBA, it was, you know, his ability to work and put the time in off the court and learn from other players was obviously going to be pivotal to his success or failure, because he was competing against, you know, the Hakeem Olajuwons and David Robinsons and Patrick Ewings at the time, and he wasn't prepared to do that. You know, he didn't have the work ethic. You know, he had constantly battling with his weight, and you know, constantly seemed have an attitude problem. But there were definite glimpses throughout his career. It's not just Clipper fans who would say, "Oh, look, Benoit Benjamin had the potential to be a really good player." You could see little windows throughout his career where, you know, he had a month here or a 2 month stretch there where he played really well and was able to compete at a really high level with the best of the best, but was never able to do that for a consistent period of time.
Yeah, I listened to a podcast, the NBA Trades podcast, with Bob Whitsitt, who was later the, you know, the general manager of the Sonics, where Benjamin played, and I think he referred to Benjamin made Joe Barry Carroll, of course, who was famously nicknamed Joe Barry Cares, made him look like the hardest worker in the world. So that gives you a sense of how bad Benjamin was as in terms of his work ethic and drive and all that kind of stuff.
Well, one of the interesting sort of stories that, you know, I found in researching the book was the time that Benoit Benjamin and Don Chaney had a physical altercation at training. And, I mean, Don Chaney is, you know, one of the sort of, you know, like a legend of the game. You know, this is the only guy to be a teammate of Bill Russell's and Larry Bird, and he's a championship winner as a player and a coach of the year, and you know, a guy that was sort of very well respected in NBA circles. And when I interviewed Don, you know, he said that, you know, he's a pretty sort of mild mannered type guy, Don Chaney. And he said to me that, you know, no one was able to push his buttons in the way that Benoit Benjamin was. And at a practice session, what happened was, you know, Benoit had walked in, had arrived late, and then instead of sort of arriving late and then quickly sort of rushing in and joining the group and apologizing, he just sort of sauntered in half pace and sat himself down on the edge of the court and slowly sort of did up his shoelaces. And Don just said, you know, he lost it. And they ended up having a screaming match that progressed to the point where Don Chaney went at Benoit Benjamin, lunged at him and attempted to choke him and had to be restrained by other players. And, you know, I spoke to lots of players who were there at the time as well and who remembered it. And the thing that they remembered that was sort of stood out for them the most was that how out of character this was for Don Chaney. So that, I mean, I think that gives you an idea of what it was like to work with Benoit Benjamin. And you know, Don Chaney's job, his job security, his financial future was linked to Benoit Benjamin. He needed to get the best out of this guy, and here he was, you know, trying to coach him, and it was, you know, like a losing battle.
So the 86 season, the Clippers had a pretty good collection of talent. You know, we talked about Marcus Johnson, Cedric Maxwell had come over from the Celtics in the Bill Walton trade. You know, Norm Nixon, James Donaldson, and, you know, Michael Cage, you know, up and coming young player, you know, some other pretty good talent there. But one emerging star they had before suffering a terrible knee injury was Derek Smith. And you did a lot of good description of, you know, the kind of the potential that Derek Smith had, how he was really, you know, showing himself to be a, you know, emerging great star, you know, going toe to toe with Michael Jordan, you know, just overcame a lot. I know Reynis Lattice of the Handle podcast also, you know, did a great look at his career as well. But you know, someone who's kind of been forgotten in the annals of NBA history due to his lack of longevity, and, you know, how he wasn't able to kind of you know, after the knee injury, he came back and played a few more seasons, but was, you know, unable to, you know, do anything like that again. But, you know, another of, I guess the beginning really of just a horrific string of luck of these, you know, really talented players going down with terrible injuries and, you know, sinking the hope of the franchise down with it.
I mean, Derek's a really fascinating story, and, you know, the type of guy that you know, made me really interested to pursue this project and to write this book, because, as you said rightly, you know, besides fans that were sort of around at that particular time, and maybe even fans that were, you know, following the Clippers would know him from that time, maybe even other fans in the league would be unaware of, you know, what an interesting sort of rise he had to, you know, at the end of his first season with Golden State. So he was a second round draft pick. He was seen as a bit of a tweener. He was seen as like, well, he's got a skill set of a power forward, but he's kind of the size of a small forward. And where does this guy fit? And the coaching staff at Golden State never really knew how to use Derek. And at the end of that season, he was waived. And I mean, really, he was out of the league. He worked hard that summer on trying to sort of reinvent his game and trying to develop his perimeter skills, but no one would give him a shot. Like he was short of a favor. The thing that kept his career alive was Jim Lynham had just been made the coach of the Clippers, and Jim was previously a assistant coach with Portland. And Stu Immonen, who was an executive at Portland, asked Jim Lynham for a favor and said, can you just put Derek Smith on your summer league team? And Jim Lynham didn't want to do it. I spoke with Jim and he said, because it was his first year coaching, he sort of overrated the importance of the summer league, and he was really sort of obsessive about having the summer league team work a particular way he wanted them to work, and he just saw it as, I don't want this guy coming from the outside and messing up the team. And so he said to Stu, I don't want to take this kid. And Stu said, you can just put him on the roster, let him practice with you. You don't even need to put him into your games. And this goes to show, I mean, this story shows how close he was to not playing in the NBA again. And from there, Jim put him on the team. You know, he impressed Jim and he worked his way up where he was the star of the summer league. He earned a spot on the Clippers roster. And Jim said that he knew in his first season that he should be starting Derek Smith. But because it was so unconventional, because Derek was such a lowly thought of player, that he didn't have the sort of courage of conviction to follow through and to put him straight in the starting lineup. And it was only when there was 20 games to go in that first season that Jim promoted Derek to the starting lineup. And straight away, you could see that this guy was, you know, phenomenal talent. You know, he was big and strong, and he was playing at shooting guard now. And opposition shooting guards just couldn't handle his physicality. And then by the next season, you know, he was scoring mid-20 points a game and was a fringe all-star and, you know, was really sort of gaining attention around the league. And then his third season with the Clippers, you know, he started off playing, you know, fantastic basketball and was named Player of the Week at the start of the season. So, I mean, Player of the Week essentially means you're the best player in the world for that week. And then not long after that, a couple of games after that, he did his knee, and it was kind of the beginning of the end for Derek's career.
So 87 and 88 are pretty deep lows for the Clippers. Elgin Baylor comes on as the general manager, not the low, but the 87 season, 12-70 record, 88 season, 17-65. We've already sort of got into, you know, all the injuries that were suffered during that time. Just the talent was not there. They had lost their draft picks, I believe, in 87. They did not have a first rounder there. However, they were able to draft Danny Manning out of Kansas in the 1988 draft, and he had led Kansas to a national championship. A player with tremendous versatility and skill as a forward, you know, looked like absolutely a future star in the league. And then 26 games into his rookie season in 89, He would suffer a torn ACL, and the Clippers would lose extend their streak of seasons with 50 or more losses to 8 straight years.
Yeah, and I mean, the consensus view is that Danny was never the same player after that knee injury. No one will really know how good Danny could have been, but he was leading into that 88 draft. He was the equivalent of Tim Duncan or Shaquille O'Neal or LeBron James, one of those draft picks that was, you know, a consensus number one pick and one that was considered to be, you know, if you landed the number one slot in the 88 draft, you were lucky because you got yourself a blue chip, you know, surefire, you know, future all-star, future all-NBA player. And as you said, I mean, he missed a whole lot of games because it was this really a hostile sort of contract negotiation between his agent, Ron Grinka, and the Clippers. And then he finally joins the team and starts working himself into, you know, peak form, and he's starting to play really well. And then, you know, after 20-something games, he does his ACL, and that's the end of his rookie season. So, yeah, really, really sad sort of story.
He does recover, and he is a very good player for the Clippers over the next few seasons as they start to accumulate some young talent. In the 1989 draft, they draft Danny Ferry, number 2 overall. But Ferry, as you talk about a lot in the book, you know, every year there is, you know, signing your number one draft pick for the most part, you know, even during that time, you know, a fairly routine matter. There were not the types of rookie scale contracts where you were kind of, you know, basically locked into a salary. There was more negotiation than that. But for most teams, you know, they would get it done in a fairly timely manner. But, you know, almost every year before this, as you mentioned with Manning and with others, there was this long negotiation that would happen. And with Danny Ferry, he was not interested in playing for the Clippers. You talk about, you know, he eventually signs in a team with Italy, and that leads to Elgin Baylor trading him to the Cavaliers for Ron Harper, who had been not in legal trouble, but had been had some friends of his or associated with some people who were in legal trouble, and they were worried about some blowback from that, and also got a pair of first round draft choices in that deal. It actually ended up being a really good trade for them, but it took a couple years for that team to gel. They also were able to get Loy Vaught, who was a pretty stalwart player for them, and ended up getting Doc Rivers as well. And it finally, in the 92 and 93 seasons, they finally became a respectable team. In 92, they broke, I believe, a 15-year playoff drought, and finally were able to, be more than the joke they had unfortunately been for, you know, for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, that 92 season is fascinating because here is what should be a sort of really good news portion of the Clipper story. But even in that season where they finally break through and make the playoffs, I mean, they had three different coaches during that season. They started off with Mike Shula, and, you know, the atmosphere around the team when Mike Shula was coaching was particularly toxic. The players, he had completely sort of lost the playing group. And, you know, some of the players I spoke to spoke about how the team had become sort of openly defiant of Mike Shula. You know, at a timeout, he would give them an instruction to do something and they would go on the court and deliberately do the opposite of what they'd been told. So, you know, the Clipper management were left with very little choice but to terminate Mike Shula. And then, you know, the assistant coach, Matt Calvin, took over, and he wanted the head coaching job, and he saw himself as being ready after being an assistant for a number of years for the head coaching job. And he coaches the team for 2 games. But in the meantime, the team's management is meeting with Larry Brown, who had also been fired during the season in highly unusual circumstances, which I detail in the book, from San Antonio. And then Larry Brown becomes the first person in NBA history to be the head coach of 2 different franchises in the same season. So, yeah, I mean, that And then that playoff series where they play Utah, which is a really fantastic playoff series, that playoff series is also disrupted by the LA riots, which came as a result of the Rodney King verdict. So, you know, what would otherwise have been a really positive sort of time in the franchise's history was still had a lot of sort of turmoil happening behind the scenes.
And they have another pretty strong season in 93. They go 41-41. Danny Manning becomes the first Clipper to make the All-Star team in seven seasons. Before the season, they trade Doc Rivers, Bo Kimble, and Charles Smith, who had been another key young contributor for the Clippers, for Mark Jackson and Stanley Roberts. As we mentioned, the team has another. You know, they give the Houston Rockets a pretty tough series, though they end up losing in five games. And then again, the team comes apart pretty soon. Larry Brown leaves the job as Larry Brown is wont to do after the '93 season. And then in '94, the Clippers are another situation where Danny Manning is about to be a free agent. Ron Harper is about to be a free agent. A lot of players, and the Clippers would have these seasons throughout their history where they would just seem to have an unusual number of guys who were going to be free agents in one season. And as you talk about in the book, and it's certainly been talked about in other places, that's usually, players at times certainly have incentives to go after their own numbers at the expense of the team, particularly if the team, is already struggling. And the Clippers absolutely do that in the 94 season under Bob Weiss.
Yeah, I mean, that is a common theme throughout the franchise's history. And I think that NBA history has shown that if you have one player, one sort of marquee player heading into a contract free agency, so, a contract year for them, that can be a positive. That can really motivate the player to play well and to sort of show his own team and other teams around the league, that he's worth sort of a big contract in the upcoming offseason. But I can't think of any example where you've had six or seven of your top players heading into free agency in the same season where that's worked out to be a positive. And, that happened throughout Clipper history. But that 94 season when Bob Weiss coached the team, that's one of the sort of more farcical seasons in NBA history. They still had a very good player, a very good playing group. I mean, the season before where they had been eliminated by Houston, I think the general view is they underachieved that year to only win 41 games. I mean, they had a very talented roster. And then the next season, what was essentially the same playing group won 27 games. They just seemed to reach a point where they didn't care anymore about they were so sort of discouraged by what was happening off the court with the franchise that people just wanted to get out of there. And then that's what happened.
Yeah. And you write about how, Harper was really adamant about not being happy in that situation, spoke out to the media often and Manning, the Clippers had come close to trading him to the Heat and then sort of pulled the offer at the last minute. And eventually they did trade Manning for Dominique Wilkins. And, we've heard, at least I've heard a lot of course, how for Hawks fans, Dominique being traded, that was, a very emotional thing for them, for him being such an important player in their franchise history. But Manning, at that point was probably the best player in Clipper history. And, that certainly must have been bittersweet for Clippers fans on that side to have, the guy, who looked like, initially might be the franchise savior to leave under those circumstances, certainly led them to their, best success they'd ever had, limited as it was. But that certainly must have been, that the feeling of losing him, even though I'm sure that there may have been some interest, in getting a player of Dominique's caliber, even at his advanced age. But that certainly must have been, it's had some emotional wallop for Clippers fans.
Yeah, but I mean, one of the... if people are going to evaluate the trade of Danny Manning, I mean, it wasn't so much a decision as to whether to trade him or not. I mean, via his agent, Ron Grinker, Danny Manning had made it abundantly clear that he was leaving at the end of that season. So that the choice was to hold on to him for another few months and then watch him leave as a free agent, or to try and get something in return. It was the exact same case with Charles Smith when Charles Smith was traded to New York. I mean, Charles Smith was a crucial piece for that team. You know, he played the center position, and he allowed the team to play a very up-tempo pace because he was able to defend bigger post players, but he was fast and agile, and that's the way that Larry Brown wanted the team to play. And it wasn't as if it was for a tactical reason, like we're going to trade Charles Smith because we think that Stanley Roberts is going to be better for us. It was a simple fact that Charles Smith had made it very clear that he was leaving, and he was going to play this final season of his contract, and he was leaving. So with a lot of these trades, that they were made almost with the loaded pistol to Aldrin Baylor's head, where he knew that the option of – it wasn't evaluating keeping a player versus trading him. It was trying to get something in return for an asset that had made it who had made it very clear they were about to leave. But yeah, the loss of Danny was really hard for Clipper fans because, you know, he was a back-to-back All-Star. He'd led them to two playoff appearances. He was a very prominent, high-profile player that Clipper fans had really grown to sort of love. And the departure of Danny Manning, you know, really signaled the end of that sort of positive period of the early 90s.
So looking at the late 90s, mostly struggles there. They win 17 games in 95. Then they trade Antonio McDyess, number two overall. And that looks like, you know, he was one of the guys with, you know, the really highest amount of potential in that draft. And then they make a pretty puzzling trade with the Nuggets for Rodney Rogers, the rights to Brent Berry and Bison Dele. And, you know, that was perplexing, I think, even at the time. And, you know, those Clip players actually played well. Brent Berry didn't really play well for the Clippers. He would go on to better success in his career. But that was one where, like, we talk about a lot of these transactions, like at the time, they don't necessarily look like they were, you know, completely disastrous. I mean, they were either trades where, like you said about like the Charles Smith, for instance, it's like they were kind of forced into that, maybe from some bad decisions, but they weren't absolutely like, it wasn't like everything that Elgin Baylor did was incompetent. In fact, he did a lot of things that were savvy and incompetent in certain periods of the team. But this one, honestly, is hard to figure from any perspective.
Yeah. I mean, I was asked in another interview, you know, that was the worst sort of transaction in Clipper history. And, you know, I was, you know, trying to scan through. There's so many different things going through my mind. And after the fact, I came to the conclusion that that was the single worst transaction in the history of the franchise. And as you said, Jason, it's hard, even at the time, you know, the coverage of that trade was completely scornful of it. And I remember there was a press conference at the time where Bill Fitch, who was the coach of the team, kind of said to the media members, like, there's no point trying to explain to you what we've done because you won't understand it. Well, I mean, he's right. The media didn't understand. I don't think anyone around the league understood it. McDyess was a fantastic player. And, you know, even his career now, we can look back at that and we probably don't fully appreciate how good he was when he was drafted, because he also suffered an injury after his first six or seven seasons. But prior to getting injured, you know, McDyess was on track to sort of be a regular All-NBA selection, and to trade him for, you know, but essentially it's kind of three spare part players. And they're all quality players, but no player in there that was capable of being a franchise player. It was perplexing, to say the least, yeah.
The 1997 team actually does make the playoffs, despite having a less than stellar record, a 36-46. And, you know, not really having a star player on that team, you know, a couple of the guys who, you know, really emerged there, you know, we already talked about Rogers and Brett Berry had a pretty small role on that team. Loy Vaught, he played well. Malik Seeley was on that team. Bo Outlaw, young Lorenzen Wright. And, you know, one guy you talk about is Derek Martin, who was a, 5'11" guard, but really, was able to, he kind of stood out for the Clippers, gave them some strong play. And, this was definitely, very unlikely playoff team. And I guess, credit to them pulling together and, the last really great coaching job of the legendary Bill Fitch.
Yeah. And you're right. A very unlikely playoff team. I think Loy Vaught was their leading scorer and he averaged somewhere around 15 points per game. And, there's no sort of name player in their entire roster. I think Derek Martin is a really interesting player for them. He was someone that, was, again, out of the league, could barely make a CBA roster. And the interesting thing about Derek Martin's journey was he then sort of went away from playing competitive basketball and went and played on the Magic Johnson's sort of traveling team. And Magic was traveling around the world with a bunch of NBA veterans and some younger CBA-level players and playing exhibitions all around the world. And he came to Melbourne and played here down in Australia. And I remember going and watching him play against our national team. And, Derek Martin was played on that team with Magic. And if you think about it, what a fantastic apprenticeship to be traveling with the arguably the greatest point guard of all time and learning from him. And then, he was ready to come back and have another try and he got himself a 10-day contract and then, eventually secured himself a permanent roster spot. So he arrives at the Clippers and he's thought of when he arrives as being a third string point guard. The idea was that Pooh Richardson and Brent Barry were going to be the primary options that Bill Fitch is going to go with. But by the middle of the season, he had grabbed the starting job and had a couple of really good games against some of the league's best players. And, he ends up being a really prominent player for maybe the most unlikely NBA playoff team of all time.
So after that, they are swept in the playoffs. The 98 season, another struggle for them. 17-65 again. And this leads to the 1998 draft where they select Michael Olajuwon, first overall. And this draft pick has been, quite maligned afterward in retrospect as one of the worst number one overall draft picks of all time. And he certainly had his struggles and, it was not, a great pick by any means, but you do make a compelling case of a first, when you look at his background, the fact that he had not played organized basketball before his college years and really had a limited track record of that. The fact that he was able to contribute at all on the level that he did, being a decent, a decent player for a few seasons and, contributing on some level, obviously not a star, obviously, but was a solid enough role player. The fact that he was able to contribute on that low level is quite remarkable. And it, as you point out in the book, if he had been drafted, eighth overall or something like that, he would not be thought of in these terrible terms. He'd just be like, okay, he was that level of player. He was fine. It's remarkable what he was able to accomplish based on his experience. But the fact that he was drafted where he was and probably for the team that he was drafted for, kind of puts him on this list of, awful draft choices when there's much more to it than that.
Yeah, the Michael Olajuwon story was a real pleasant surprise for me in the course of doing this research because, as you said, Jason, Michael Olajuwon is universally regarded as, just being a draft bust and his career in the NBA having been a failure and there's so much more to him than that. I mean, he's a really interesting guy. He at the age of 20, he decided he was going to play in the NBA and he was living in London at the time and, picked up the phone and started cold calling American colleges and saying, hey, you know, I'm a 7 foot guy living in England, and I want to come and play for you. And you know, he called some of the more prominent schools like Duke and Georgetown, and he couldn't get a coach on the phone. They kind of didn't take him seriously. So then he changed tack and he said, okay, I'm going to open up this guidebook of US colleges at a random page and plonk my finger down with my eyes closed, and wherever it lands, I'm going to call that school. And so he ended up landing on the University of the Pacific, picked up the phone and called University of Pacific and said, hey, you know, I want to come over and play for you guys. And I spoke to a number of the coaches at Pacific who worked with Michael while he was there, and they said that, you know, one of the things that was really remarkable about him was how driven and how hard he worked and how focused he was on this goal of making the NBA. And part of what I think made that goal achievable was that he was completely unaware of what a ludicrous goal it was. Like he arrived in America and his first practice session, he just showed a complete lack of exposure to the game of basketball. He didn't know how to catch a ball and pivot. He didn't know how to make a layup. He didn't understand the rules of the game. This is someone who had literally never played a game of organized basketball in his life. And he's on the campus of a Division I school. And he spent much of his first season at Pacific trying to bluff his way through, you know, pretending that he knew more about the game than what he did. And there's stories about, one time he was fouled in a game and made a basket, and so he was sent to the free throw line for one bonus free throw. And after he shot the first free throw and missed, the opposition team grabbed the rebound and started running down court. And Michael was left standing at the free throw line wondering why he was not being given a second free throw attempt. I mean, this is an amazing sort of journey to go from that in year one to the end of year three being the number one overall draft pick. But obviously his time with the Clippers didn't work out. And it seems to be that the Michael Oliver Candy that played in college was the same attitude, that same sort of pig-headedness, drivenness to say, I'm going to do this and I don't care what anyone says, that served him really well while he was at Pacific. And I believe that same attitude was partly to do with his lack of success in the pros.
Yeah, and you talk about him working with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on a couple separate occasions, and it going reasonably well the first time, and showing some signs of improvement there, and then he's brought back a year or two later, and there being a real difference of opinion between them of Ola Candy not saying, telling Kareem, you don't criticize me in front of anyone, in front of my teammates and that kind of thing, which, basically, he's working with him with the other team. He has to, made it impractical for him to really be able to do anything with him. And, Kareem's a guy who has had difficulty getting along with others at times too. So that there may be more than one side to that story, but it is that you can see the other side of that coin of being so driven and so focused and so single-minded and accomplishing what he did, just with his will and his desire, where the other side of that coin is that, you can believe in yourself too much or not being willing to listen, or you're feeling you've achieved enough and don't need to listen anymore. And then it leads to, it kind of stalling out despite, again, him, being a solid player for his career, being okay, certainly, compared to the, litany of all the NBA players who have been out there, he was, productive enough, had a decent enough career.
Yeah. I believe that Michael saw the becoming the number one overall draft pick as the finish line rather than the start of his professional career.
Right.
Which is understandable in a way. I'm not saying it's the way I would have approached it, but I mean, he worked so hard. It was such an unbelievable journey to go from where he was to becoming the number one overall draft pick. I believe that at that point he kind of looked at it as like, well, now I've made it. I've got a contract for millions of dollars. I'm playing in the NBA. And rather than sort of seeing as, well, now I've got another mountain to climb and this mountain's going to be even bigger than the previous one, you know, and in fairness to Michael, I mean, he joined a team that, you know, was devoid of veteran leadership, that, you know, didn't have a sort of strong culture, you know, didn't have a coaching staff with a lot of sort of authority. And, you know, I believe his career would have panned out differently if he was drafted lower. I also believe it would have panned out differently if he had been drafted by a different organization, you know, but you can never, we'll never know that one way or the other.
Yeah, but there are, as we've kind of talked about, there are so many outcomes with the Clippers, with who they draft or how things go with trades, where it literally ends at the worst it possibly could end. Like, you know, if you look at all the different outcomes of, you know, how could this work out, it is, you know, below the average or close to the worst outcome so many times, where you have to figure, you know, especially with draft picks, obviously a team that a player's drafted, you know, can make so much difference for, you know, players at almost all levels. And I think there's a good evidence that it would have been different for Olakande if it had been different. So moving on to the early 2000s, the 99 and 2000 are very big struggles, but they do start to accumulate some intriguing young talent and some, you know, really good young players. Lamar Odom, Darius Miles, Corey Maggette, Quentin Richardson, you know, are all key players in the 2001 season. They are all 21 or younger and all, you know, have some good years. They improved significantly that year from 15 wins to 31 wins, starting to look like, you know, they're a team that's kind of getting some acclaim for, you know, like, you know, a young team on the rise. You know, I guess not that different from what, you know, the sort of the Timberwolves situation has been in the last year. No one who I think is quite was as touted as Karl Anthony Towns, but, you know, not too far, you know, away from that. The, you know, 2001 or so Clippers had a lot of hype during that time.
Yeah. And I think, again, I think that's sort of a credit to Elgin that he did a good job of, you know, drafting and trading for draft picks and gathering a really nice collection of young, talented players. And then the challenge is, as always, is then how do you then mold that team and, you know, make little tweaks as you go? Because, I mean, they probably had a few too many players who were similar, who played similar positions and things like that. But I mean, the first step is to accumulate the assets. And then I guess you look at, you know, trading and whatever to sort of build your team from there. The next step that they took was the trade for Elton Brand, which was a really, you know, I mean, arguably Elgin's best move as a general manager. In that draft, there was a lot of that was the draft that had you know, Kwame Brown and Tyson Chandler, Eddie Curry. So I mean, the idea that they would draft another young guy, I mean, these are guys coming out of high school, you know, that didn't appeal to the Clippers, but they managed to sort of flip the draft pick and get a very young player, someone who had already proven themselves at the NBA level. So yeah, they looked like they were ready to take the next step, really.
Yeah, and Brand, you know, had uncommon maturity and, you know, was someone who you could definitely count on. And like I said, it was only 2 years out of from being Rookie of the Year. So he was, he was young enough where it was absolutely a smart call, but, you know, made sense with their talent. They improved to 39 wins in the 0-2 season, and things are looking up. And they make what seems like a savvy trade, trading away Darius Miles for Andre Miller, another, you know, fairly young mid-20s player. Who, you know, was, you know, we have to know Andre Miller, you know, a smart point guard, a guy who, you know, made teams better for a lot of his career, even though it didn't necessarily have flashy numbers. But that's another situation where there are, you know, incredible number of, you know, contract years on that team. In 03, Lamar Odom has had, you know, some personal problems during this time, some drug suspensions and other issues, and it really seems to fall apart that year. They regress, only winning 27 games, and, you know, the end of Alvin Gentry's time as the Clippers coach. Dennis Johnson comes in as the interim coach toward the end of the season as well. But that's a That kind of ended that run for the Clippers, although they'd, you know, emerged fairly quickly with some of that talent into bigger and better things. But that was that's sort of your, where you look and you wonder, you know, what must have happened there. I think you know the book, you attribute it to, you know, the fact that, again, that so many young players on contract years and just, you know, are kind of torn apart from those goals. But that's sort of a that's a baffling one looking at it from the outside.
Yeah, the trade for Andre Miller was one of those moves, Jason, that people, you know, at the time you looked at and you said, yep, this is the perfect move now. That's the next thing. You know, they definitely, whilst Darius was very popular, both with the fans and with his teammates, I mean, history would suggest they made the right move in trading him away. And they clearly had a surplus of forwards. I mean, they had, you know, already had Elton Brand, they had Lamar Odom, they had Corey Maggette, who was playing a little bit at the two spot, but also playing at the three spot. So they clearly were able to trade Darius away, and Andre Miller seemed to be a great fit. He was from California, as you said. You know, he was regarded as one of the best young point guards in the league. He had led the NBA in assists during the previous season and had played for Team USA over the summer of 2002, which wasn't a happy time. But you know, he was selected as one of the 12 players to represent the country. So, I think the Clippers kind of modeled that on what New Jersey had done 12 months earlier in trading for Jason Kidd. Then they saw that, like, okay, here New Jersey have taken, you know, another franchise that's traditionally struggled, had some nice young talent and, you know, a nice sort of mix of athletic players and, you know, and then they went and acquired Jason Kidd and sort of completely turned their franchise around. And I think the Clippers were hoping for the same outcome by acquiring Andre Miller, but it was a train wreck. It was, you know, Andre Miller was very unhappy being there, and, you know, there was a lot of sort of internal squabbling, and there's so many players heading into free agency, and responsibility on that has to go back to the ownership of the team, that they had the option of signing up some of these players before the season. Even if they had signed them up as a sort of show of good faith to let the other players on the team know that, hey, there's a potential here that if we do the right thing and we play well, we'll be financially rewarded. But they chose to let them all sort of dangle into free agency, and the outcome was pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. So now we begin the Dunleavy era, and the first year that you still have Brand and Maggette and Quentin Richardson, they start 22-25, but then they finish 28-54, which is quite an amazing drop off in that second year. But they are accumulating some talent. They get Chris Kamen, they get Sean Livingston, who's, you know, an exciting young point guard for them. They have Marco Jarić, who looks at the time like he might be, you know, he's showing some nice things, and he eventually would be sent to Minnesota to get Sam Cassell. So, you know, they're starting to they're starting to kind of make that, getting close to, you know, the run that they would make in 2006. But there's also, you know, Mike Dunleavy comes in, and there's a strange situation where he is told by Donald Sterling that he is, you know, given some or full authority over player personnel, while Elgin Baylor is the general manager and not told about the situation. And that seems to lead to some, some conflict and some difficulties, you know, later on, especially.
Yeah. And obviously that would lead to conflict down the road, but, you know, Donald seemed to be wowed by Mike Dunleavy and believed that he was the person who could turn the franchise around. So he essentially handed him the keys and said, you know, you're in charge. And it seemed that nobody thought it was a good idea to inform Elgin of what was happening. And one of the people I spoke to, Barry Hecker, you know, he was working in the front office at the time. I think he was the director of player personnel. And he said that in the lead up to the draft that they took Sean Livingston in, Sean Livingston was one of the players they were looking at, but they were also looking at some other players. And they were seriously considering drafting Devin Harris, And in one of the meetings where they were discussing this, you know, Mike Dunleavy just announced, well, like, I'm taking Sean Livingston. And, you know, Barry Hecker was like, well, wait, is this an I'm deal or is this a we deal? Like, are you working with us? Is this a team that we're deciding together or are you deciding? And, you know, that was maybe the first glimpse into what was going to later become a bigger problem, whereby you had two different camps thinking they were running the show, and that had been orchestrated by Donald.
So the 06 team, as you mentioned, they add Sam Cassell, they add Katino Mobley, they eventually add Vladimir Radmanovic, and they are 47-35. They, you know, have the real, you know, first real strong team in more than a decade, and, you know, and this is, you know, they advance to the second round for the first time since they have been the Clippers. But it's interesting, like, even though, you know, there's so much success in the season, there's so many good vibes, there's this weird situation with the NBA seeding rules at the time where they just gone to six divisions, and the if you won your division, you automatically were given a top three seed. It was advantageous for them to tank to finish sixth in the West and to meet the third seeded Nuggets, who were a worse team and who they would have had home court advantage on. So even though they, you know, and it leads to this like farcical last game of the season against the Grizzlies, who they are competing with for the fifth. The winner gets the fifth seed, the loser gets the sixth seed. And, you know, it comes to the point where they are basically coming really, really close, if not actually, you know, playing the game to lose. And it was smart of them to do that, and obviously just, you know, weird incentives for them to do. But, you know, they have to kind of Clippers their way into the playoffs, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, really fascinating. I don't think I think you can almost guarantee that game against Memphis against the Grizzlies will never appear on NBA Hardwood Classics.
Yeah,
you know, I don't think it's saying that the league would want to highlight. But I mean, you can't blame the Clippers. They had the situation where the two best teams in the West were both the Texas teams, and so Dallas and San Antonio, one was going to finish number one in the West, but whoever didn't win the Midwest division was going to drop all the way to number four. So if the Clippers finished number five, they were going to end up playing a much tougher opponent. So it was in their interest to tank and to deliberately lose, which they did. Which it appears they did. I mean, and even the comments from the players at the time reflect the fact that they were well aware of the seeding situation. But it worked in their favor because they got the matchup they wanted against Denver, and they played very well against Denver, and they broke through and finally won their first playoff series as the Clippers. So, I mean, it definitely worked in their favor.
Yeah, and that second round series against the Suns, you know, there's some real classics in that series. I mean, there's a double overtime game in Game 5. There's some there were, you know, some really tense moments there. Game 3 is really exciting. You know, the last game, unfortunately, for the Clippers, the Game 7 was not a particularly close game, even though Elton Brand, you know, had 36 points and you played really well throughout that entire series. And some of the strategic, changes between the coaches, you know, with the Clippers creating a situation where Nash can't hide on, you know, Quentin Ross, who was a good defensive player but not doing much offensively, where he had to guard someone who was effective, and just the, you know, the chess match between Mike D'Antoni and Mike Dunleavy, you know, some fascinating aspects about that series. I mean, and, you know, they came really close to to beating the Clippers there. I mean, to beating the Suns in that series. I mean, that was a really tough series, and, you know, they certainly had a, you know, it looked like this was a team that was, you know, had some growth potential. You know, most of their main players were still in their mid-20s. They had, you know, their young stud point guard of the future, Sean Livingston, who was only 20 years old and was playing really well in limited minutes, just, you know, kind of showing what he could do. And, And then they end up getting a they signed Tim Thomas, who had an amazing playoff run for the Suns and had shown some really good signs at times of being an excellent player. And I believe basically brought everyone else back, and it looked like they were, you know, going to have another chance to be, you know, to, you know, build on momentum and be a really good team. And then, unfortunately, you know, more tragedy struck the team.
Yeah. The I think the series against the Suns was a really fascinating one, and maybe a decade ahead of its time in terms of the style of play between the two teams. A lot of sort of smaller lineups and a lot of, you know, making sure that you had, you know, four players on the court at all time that could shoot the three-pointer. And you know, the trade to get Vladimir Radmanovic in the middle of the season was really crucial to the style of basketball that Dunleavy wanted to play. And they did look, I mean, that year, 2006, Miami won the championship, and I think that they won 50 or 52 regular season games that year. So that was a year that maybe the championship was a little bit up for grabs. And the Clippers were, you know, a couple of seconds away from potentially winning that series. And they were, as you said, Jason, they looked positioned to be ready now for some real long-term sustained improvement. They had a nice nucleus of young players. And, you know, whilst Cassell was on his way out and he was a crucial player on that team, you know, Sean Livingston appeared to be ready to step in and to, you know, become an all-star caliber player. And then, you know, in two successive years, you had Sean Livingston suffer, you know, the most horrendous injury that's ever taken place on an NBA court. And then, you know, a few months later in the offseason, you have Elton Brand get injured whilst he's playing one-on-one with Chris Kaman. And essentially there goes your the two players you're building around.
And leads, of course, to another transition era for the team. You know, Brand was able to come back at the end of the 08 season and play pretty well and show that, okay, you know, maybe he'll be back to form and, you know, there we can go along with him. And they also have cap space and they have the opportunity to sign Baron Davis to go along with Elton Brand. And as you write in the book, there are differences of opinion of exactly what went down. But Baron Davis thought that Elton Brand was coming back. Mike Dunleavy thought that Elton Brand was coming back. But Elton Brand signed elsewhere with the 76ers and left the Clippers to scramble again.
Yeah, so, you know, you had this situation where one of the things that Elton's agent was saying that, you know, that they wanted to see the Clippers go out and secure a all-star caliber point guard. And Baron Davis was, you know, similar to when Marcus Johnson returned home. You know, here's Baron Davis, you know, someone that was really loved in Los Angeles, you know, grew up in South Central and played his college ball at UCLA and had gone on to be an NBA All-Star and one of the sort of most popular players in the league. And so, you know, the Clippers were able to go out and they were able to sign him and there was all this excitement around signing him. And for a couple of days it was like, well, we've got Baron, we're about to re-sign Elton, this team's ready to take off again. The problem was that, you know, when Mike Dunleavy talks about, you know, how he felt that that Elton Brand had made a commitment to re-sign, they were negotiating directly, you know, Mike Dunleavy speaking directly to Elton Brand, and they weren't communicating through his agent. And once David Falk, who's was Elton's agent, discovered that that was taking place, you know, he said, stop, you know, no more communication with them, let me do my job. And he went out and he secured a better deal for Elton, and Elton left.
So the and I'm not sure, you know, given that Baron Davis was, I you know, in a bit of a decline phase in his career, and Elton Brand, he was still a good player for a while, but was not, you know, the same player he would have been. I'm not sure that that was going to necessarily lead the Clippers into the promised land anyway, but obviously, you know, disappointing that they didn't have a chance to put that together. And 09 is kind of a lost year. You know, they do trade for Zach Randolph, who unfortunately was still in the midst of a rough transition phase of his career before he would find his home in Memphis. They end up finishing 19-63, but they are able to get Blake Griffin with the number one pick. Obviously, the exciting new star there. But one thing I should mention before that is the a really big move. I think it was during that same summer where they were with Baron Davis and Elton Brand is Elgin Baylor leaves the organization after, you know, a 23 or so years with the team. And it's sort of unclear what it was unclear at the time exactly what had happened, other than, you know, it was just announced that Dunleavy was given the general manager duties. Then Baylor later files a huge lawsuit against the team and against the NBA for, you know, racial discrimination and for, you know, other things, you know, revealing a lot of, you know, embarrassing things that Donald Sterling had said and a lot of, you know, mistreatment that he alleged and, you know, all these, you know, giving a hint of what it was like to, you know, work under Donald Sterling for all those years.
Yeah. And, you know, he spoke, one of the more interesting thing was, you know, like financially, you know, what he was being paid relative to other NBA general managers, which was, you know, like I think his final year he was on under 400,000, which, I mean, I'm for you or I, that might be a great salary, but I mean, for an NBA general manager, it was well below what the market rate was. And there was part of the process of filing the lawsuit, there was a whole lot of allegations that were made of things that were said, you know, racially insensitive comments and some things that were just, yeah, that would just blow your mind to hear said in a professional setting, in a workplace, or it's, you know, to be said anywhere. But ultimately, nothing comes of this. You know, the racial element of the lawsuit was eventually dropped, and it ended up being primarily dealt with on the basis of whether he was discriminated against on the basis of his age. You know, the jury found in favor of the Clippers, and Elgin lost his lawsuit, and wasn't until sort of years later when the tape was leaked, the V. Stiviano tape was leaked in 2014, that a lot of this focus came back on what happened with Elgin Baylor when he was terminated as general manager.
So as we mentioned, Blake Griffin is drafted, but he misses the 2010 season with injury. Mike Dunleavy quits as the coach to become general manager to focus on those duties, but ends up getting fired after the season anyway. So we begin a new era with Vinny Del Negro as the coach in 2011. Baron Davis is traded out of the team. Mo Williams comes in. It's mostly a salary-related trade, and there is a first round draft pick attached to it, which is not necessarily thought of much at the time. The Clippers are 30-52, you know, not a good team, but not one of the worst teams in the league. But suddenly that ends up becoming the number one pick, and the Clippers end up giving the Cavs a number one pick in what was essentially a salary dump. So another frustrating situation for the franchise, and kind of the last thing you might think of as far as the Clippers curse goes until the good times really start rolling in for the team.
Yeah, and you know, that's, I mean, any other franchise that draft pick ends up becoming Kyrie Irving. I mean, any other franchise, that would be something that would be thought about and spoke about to this day. But with the Clippers, it's just one of, you know, many sort of things that have happened to the team over the years. I believe at the time that the team tried to justify it by saying that they couldn't place protection on the first round draft pick because of other trades they had made in the past. And I mean, I'm not a collective bargaining agreement expert, But there's no doubt that it was a bad trade. However, I mean, if that trade hadn't have happened and they had a drafted Kyrie, I mean, they probably don't end up, you know, completing the trade for Chris Paul. So, you know, in hindsight, maybe it worked out for them, but, you know, it's one of the, I mean, it's maybe like the Danny Ferry trade. You know, they drafted Danny Ferry, which was a bad move. I mean, history shows Danny Ferry was not a very good number two draft pick, but, you know, they end up trading him for Ron Harper and then they get a draft pick that turns into Loi Voigt. So maybe it's one of those situations that in the short term it was a bad move, but in the long term it kind of all worked out for them.
Yeah, they were able to, of course, you know, the next season get Chris Paul in a trade, giving up Eric Gordon in that trade and beginning the Lob City era for the Cavs with Blake Griffin and emerging DeAndre Jordan, and the Clippers have been a very good team since then over the past five seasons and continuing into this season. You know, they've been a 50 plus win team all of those seasons. And, you know, really are, you know, they certainly had their disappointments in the playoffs, and they had, you know, the Donald Sterling scandal in 2014 when those, you know, tapes came to light and he was forced out as the owner of the team. But, you know, they have been largely a very good organization. But it's interesting because I feel like, you know, whenever they do something that, you know, would happen to a, you know, that would happen to a good team, like blowing the 3-1 lead to the Rockets in the second round in 2015 after, you know, that great 7-game series in the first round against the Spurs, or, you know, losing to the Blazers in the first round in 2016 after, you know, Paul and Blake both had injuries, it's still viewed for this same prism a lot of ways as, oh, it's the same old Clippers. You know, even though they've done so much to, you know, become a better team, especially, you know, as Doc Rivers was hired and, you know, and Steve Ballmer has, you know, become the new owner, and they've changed a lot about what they do, and they're, you know, much more professional organization, I think, in basically every facet. You know, they certainly make their mistakes, but they generally make the kind of mistakes that a good team makes, so that every team makes, not the kind of, you know, mistakes that were, you know, holding them back, you know, under Donald Sterling's ownership for so many years.
Yeah, yeah, I guess the counter to that would be if you look at, so there's been two completed seasons since Steve Ballmer purchased the team. A team losing a series when they're up 3-1 is an extremely rare occurrence, and the fact that they were up 3-1 and then in game six they had a giant lead,
right,
and Houston had essentially, you know, pulled all their starters out, and here's Josh Smith, you know, the guy who's renowned for being a bad, you know, there's one thing people know about Josh Smith is the guy loves jacking up threes and he can't shoot threes. And all of a sudden, Josh Smith shoots Houston to victory. I mean, that's kind of, that's a tough, I mean, I've spoken with, since the book's been published, you know, speak to a lot of Clipper fans, you know, who connect via social media and everything. And yeah, that's something that the fans of the team just found such a bitter pill to swallow. And then the following season to have their two superstar players get injured in the same playoff game. Again, you know, like you'd have to go back very far through NBA history to find more than I can't think off the top of my head of another example of a team losing their best two players in the same playoff game. And as we said at the start, I don't think there is a curse, but, you know, there's so much misfortune that's happened to this team over such a long period of time, and it has preceded Donald's ownership of the team. You know, Bill Walton's injury troubles happened under Irv Levin's ownership, and it has continued after Steve Ballmer's purchased the team. So, I mean, I look forward to. I thought this season when they started off 14-2, you know, I was really optimistic that this was going to be the year that they surpassed all their expectations and made it through to the finals. And I think they're potentially still a championship contender. But then, you know, you've had injuries to Paul and Griffin again. And it's just kind of like Groundhog Day.
So what team today, in your view, is most like Donald Sterling's Clippers?
Wow. I mean, given the events of All-Star Weekend, you know, you'd have to say Sacramento. You know, the trading away DeMarcus Cousins in the way that they did it is, again, we were speaking before about the when the Clippers trade away McDyess, and this reminds me of that. You know, I could see the motivation for trading him away. I mean, he's been there for 6 years, and you know, they've never made the playoffs, and there's been so many sort of cultural problems around the team that are linked directly to DeMarcus Cousins and DeMarcus Cousins' demeanor and the way he approaches the game. So I could see the motivation for trading him. I can't make sense of the trade and what the thinking is and what they're trying to do. And it's one example of a number of sort of bad moves that Sacramento have made over the past few years. And I imagine that what the Clippers fan base experienced in the sort of, mid-90s would be very similar to what the Sacramento fan base are experiencing now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Knicks are also, you know, under James Dolan's leadership of the past 16 years or so that's a similar one where I think Dolan just shares a lot of personality traits with Donald Sterling. Maybe not the vile racism, but the just eccentric, you know, personal decisions, meddling in things, not necessarily being cheap with the franchise because they make so much money. Although there's definitely, you know, talk of that their need to be controlling in these atmospheres and them, you know, really sometimes being invasive in players' personals, you know, just not allowing any kind of privacy or that, or just I do feel like there's a culture within the Knicks, but maybe it's never been as bad as the Clippers, but I feel like there's some similarities. And as you talked about with the always trying to, you know, kind of get the big fish, and rather than building the team organically, for many of the Clippers years, that has been sort of a, you know, atmosphere there. I guess the only other one would be the Timberwolves, just because they have not made the playoffs in 12, 13 seasons, and you know, there were some real lows under the David Kahn era. They seem to have been a better run franchise under, you know, Flip Saunders until he passed away, and now under Thibodeau. But I think, yeah, those are probably the closest comparisons I can think of. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they're both good comparisons. I think the Knicks one's really interesting. You know, the Knicks, I mean, the James Dolan Knicks, if there's any, they kind of have, there's a lot of similarities, like especially if you think about scandals as well. You think about what happened with Isaiah Thomas and, you know, disputes with coaches and all sorts of stuff. So there's that link. But the Knicks in another way, I mean, their biggest problem has been that they've been too willing to spend money, which is the opposite to the Clippers. You know, if they had a tighter budget and they were less inclined to go and chase, your Joakim Noahs and your, like, you know, there's been countless examples of them, grabbing players at the end of their careers at just the wrong time to grab that player, and spending a lot of money and then being locked into, you know, going all the way back to Allen Houston, you know, being locked into this huge salary for someone who's not really worthy of that salary, and then compounding the error by bringing in other big name players, and you know, they're almost like a kid running a fantasy team where they're just going for name players as opposed to looking at different parts and how they'll fit together and what actually goes into making a successful team.
So, last question, unless there's anything else you want to share after that. Who is your favorite Clipper of all time?
That's a great question. Favorite Clipper of all time. Look, as a fan, I think, and you know, I don't want to go personal with people that I interviewed, but it just as strictly as a fan, I think my favorite Clipper of all time is Derek Smith, who we spoke about a lot earlier. And you know, obviously, Derek sadly passed away, and so I wasn't able to speak with Derek for the book. Spoke with a lot of his former teammates and coaches, and you know, everybody that I spoke to just said that as a man, as a human being, that he was such a wonderful person. And just the NBA world is sadder for having lost Derek, and I think that you know, his life story was so interesting. But yeah, he's my favorite Clipper of all time. Yeah.
Like I said, it is a fantastic book. I highly recommend for, you know, if you're a serious enough NBA fan to be listening to our podcast, you will definitely enjoy the book. So you should absolutely certainly check it out. It is, again, called The Curse, The Colorful and Chaotic History of the LA Clippers. We'll have a link to it in the show notes for you to be able to buy the book. So, Mick, thank you so much for being on the show. And thank you, everyone, for checking us out. You can find us at thestepback@fansided.com. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcast. Just search for Over and Back. And you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook at Over and Back NBA. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.